We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. There is no doubt that Barack Obama's run for the presidency changed history, but here's a question. Did it change American politics? Our guest for this hour of Focus, a longtime political consultant, Douglas Schoen, says the answer to that question is no. Problems with media coverage, with voter apathy, and with campaign funding persist. However, he also makes the argument in a book that we'll be talking about this morning that these things can change. The book is titled The Political Fix, the subtitle Changing the Game of American Democracy from the Grassroots to the White House. It's published by Times Books and is just out. In his book, he proposes some changes to the way campaigns are financed, how primaries are run, and how elections are covered, all things that he says could well transform America's political system. Douglas Schoen has been a Democratic Party advisor for the past 30 years. He's a founding partner of Penn, Schoen, and Berland Associates. He was former President Bill Clinton's strategic consultant during the 1996 re-election campaign. He has also advised a number of other people, including the mayor of New York City, former Indiana Governor Evan Bayh, and former British Prime Minister Tony Blair. He's the author of 5 books, including The Political Fix, which is just out. As we talk, questions are welcome. We'd certainly welcome people to call in, ask questions, make comments. We hope that people will be brief. That way you make room for as many different people as we'd like to call in, and we'll get in as many as we can. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You may also send us your comments and questions by email, and the address is will-talk@illinois.edu. And Mr. Schoen, hello.
Yeah, I'm here. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for giving us some of your time.
Please.
Just to begin with the main point where you do, that was the sort of the place I began my introduction. No doubt, President Obama, Barack Obama's campaign and his election were historic and did indeed change some things. But overall, if you ask the question, I'm sure a lot of people have asked you that question. Well, truly, did his election change American politics? The answer that you come up with is no, it really
didn't. I don't think it did. I mean, he was talking about ushering in a new era of politics, bipartisanship, changing the culture of Washington. And I think anybody who's looked for the last year and a half, and it's certainly not all the president or the Democrats' fault, but anyone who looks at what's happened would have to say that politics as usual rules the day.
Yeah. And you, I'm sure that then if you asked, well, what really contributes to that, you come up with a number of things and you deal with a number of them in your book. I don't know if there's any particular place that you want to start. I suppose we could start by talking about money and politics.
Well,
that really is the place you start with.
Yeah,
the book.
I mean, you look at the influence of special interests on politics and the role of PAC contributions and the like, Wall Street, big oil, and the like. And it's hard to say that their influence has been broken or their influence in any way has been retarded. So I think we're looking at a system that is money-driven, fundraising-driven, and where the kind of rational consensus and compromise that used to be the hallmark of our system has largely disappeared.
Yeah. There is a graph in the book that shows presidential campaign spending, and it's very striking. First of all, it's very striking that the big increase between 1980 and 2008, but it's also striking that, say, between 1980 and 2000, while the spending went up, it was a relatively gradual upward trend, and then in 2000, things just took off like a rocket, and there was this enormous increase between 2000 and 2008. Was there something in particular that happened around 2000 to cause that to occur?
Yeah, I think we had an explosion of wealth in the 1990s, fueled by both the real estate boom later and the tech boom then. And I think you had a vast category of new wealth created, and into the political system. And, I mean, I think between the party committees and his own campaign, President Obama spent over $500 million on the election. And as I think you remember, he eschewed public funding.
Right. You then go on to write something, and I think that probably initially here, when people hear this discussion of money in politics, they would agree with you completely and say that that's really a problem. We ought to do something about that. But then you go on and write something that then may cause some people to say, well, wait a minute, because it seems that the argument you're making is it's not purely the amount of money that's being spent that's really the problem. Is it that where the money from where the money comes?
Oh, that's exactly right. I happen to think, in a certain sense, more information in a political campaign, which frequently involves more money, is not necessarily a bad thing. It's the concentration of wealth and power and ultimately special interest influences that I think is most destructive. So it's where it comes from which is most bothersome.
Yeah. Certainly one of the things that the Obama campaign did do is they, to the extent that I think no one had done it before, they used the internet as a fundraising tool and did raise a lot of money from small contributors, people who were contributing small amounts of money. Would the solution or at least a step in the right direction be to do what could be done to encourage more individuals to give small amounts of money?
Oh, I think that's a very good idea. I don't think money in politics per se is bad. In fact, I think to a very large degree it's good, particularly when it's citizen-inspired contributions because of concern about the system. I think the aspect of the Obama campaign that deserves great recognition is the ability to do what you just described, which is to raise large amounts of money from small donors over time. That's terrific, but it's the concentration of wealth and power and special interest money that is clearly at the root of many of our problems.
Yeah. Well, although I'm sure that some people would say as long as we have incumbents who have great advantages, we have and people who are backed by the parties that have a lot of money to spend, and also because the Supreme Court has said you can't limit someone's campaign spending because that's a matter of First Amendment rights. So then any very wealthy individual, if you had a vast fortune and you wanted to spend it all on running for office, you could. That gives certain candidates, certain people, tremendous advantages that it's difficult for others to overcome. Is there any way to really to level that playing field?
Yeah, I think a public financing system that rewards candidates with matched amounts of funds for doing exactly what you described, which is raising small dollar contributions from ordinary people, is a step in the right direction. Again, I have worked with a lot of wealthy candidates who self-fund, and that may not be entirely fair, but it usually doesn't involve a special interest.
Mm-hmm.
What I worry about is when the oil industry or the financial industry or the toxic dumpers or some special interest that's contrary to the broader public interest gets together to try to influence the public debate and the electoral process. That, I think, is destructive and disturbing.
And I suppose one has to say that there have been examples, I'm sure one could point to many examples, of self-funded campaigns, individuals who spent a lot of money running for office who lost. So that does not necessarily mean you're going to win.
I think 90% of self-funders lose, and most who win usually are in it not because they want to do the bidding of a special interest, but because they've had great success in some career and they are looking to be in public service. Now, their motivation may be questioned, but they usually don't get into politics because they were real estate developers and they want to lower taxes on capital gains.
Yeah. Clearly, I think a lot of this money ends up being spent on campaign advertising, and this is something from which commercial broadcasters earn a lot of money, so they're not particularly interested in seeing that change. At the same time, I think also there are people who suggest that one thing that could be done is to require broadcasters to give time to candidates.
Well, you know, I made that recommendation in the book, and I feel pretty strongly about it because, you know, I'm involved in a couple of campaigns now where candidates are justifiably complaining about the cost of campaigning. But ultimately, if you look at where their money is going, it's going to private media interests who charge top dollar for television time. And somehow, that to me is as destructive of the process as is the role of special interests.
Yeah. So overall, though, it seems that one problem you have here in changing campaign finance is that there was only so much that you can do with legislation. And I think at the end of the day, if there's going to be change, it's going to have to be voluntary, and everybody who's involved in the business is going to have to agree. And that seems to be the tough thing.
Boy, it's very tough. I think some of it can be done legislatively, as I tried to indicate in the political fix, but I think a large part of it has to be done through media pressure, disclosure, and ultimately a consensus that the system has to change.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus is Douglas Schoen. He has been a Democratic Party advisor for the past 30 years. He's founding partner of Penn, Schoen, and Berland. He was a strategic consultant to President Bill Clinton during the 1996 reelection campaign. He's also advised a lot of politicians, among them Michael Bloomberg, mayor of New York City, Evan Bayh, former governor of Indiana, and also former British Prime Minister Tony Blair. He's the author or co-author of 6 books, and he has a new one out here we're talking about. The title of the book is The Political Fix, Changing the Game of American Democracy from the Grassroots to the White House, and it's published by Times Books. It's out now. And as always here, we're inviting comments, questions from people who are listening. Again, people can help us by keeping it brief, but if you want to call in, share your thoughts, you can do that. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and you also may email your thoughts to will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a caller in Belgium, Illinois, on our line 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. Mr. Inns just aptly pointed out that large broadcasters just rub their hands together every other year saying, here's another influx of cash. But, you know, if you take and look at all the other nations in the world, their election systems are such that they don't depend upon these huge influx of cash to go to media outlets. The elections don't go on for Mr. Obama's went on for 18 months, wasn't it? Something like that. Why, since, and also other countries also put it so that the airways are really owned by the people of the country in a way, and they put it out in such a way that, you know, you have to come to them to get the permission to do it in some sort of way. Maybe I'm not putting that quite right, but you understand what I'm saying. The people own it. So why don't we mandate that all these corporations that make such huge sums of money from this say, wait a minute, you're going to, for the right to use the airwaves for your broadcast all the rest of the time, you're just going to provide that service for limited commercial aspects of politics and make it to a reasonable period of time. 18 months is way too long to spend, like you said, $500 million?
Yeah, about that. That's right.
So why don't we see the sense that the rest of the world is seeing?
Well, I agree. I mean, I've worked around the world. I've certainly worked in the United States, and your question is a fair one. I address it in the book, and I reach the same conclusion that you do, which is that our system is skewed in the direction of these large media companies, and all that we're doing is taking very, very wealthy people and asking them to give money to equally, if not greater, wealth, which is concentrated in these media companies. So I think that's a large part of the problem. And surprise, surprise, you know who doesn't address this issue? The media.
Obviously, they want to keep their cake and eat it, too.
Of course they do.
Yes. Well, I guess we get the government we buy pay for.
Sadly, you're right.
All right. Thank you for the call. And I do think that it's an interesting point the caller makes about the length of campaigns. And it does seem to be the case, if you look around the world, that their election campaigns are much shorter. And I don't know if that's somehow formally bound, or that's just a kind of agreement that they've come to, that they're going to be only so long. It'll be for some period of, I don't know, a month or 2 months or something before the election, and that's it.
Well, I think there's nothing wrong with having a campaign for, you know, more than a couple of months, 3 to 6 months. But clearly, the caller is correct to suggest that an 18-month campaign followed by the permanent campaign is absurd. I mean, you know, we don't consider the issues. We consider political tactics.
Do you do you think that things are more partisan now than they have been in the past? That's probably the wrong question. I think the question probably is, how do you account for the very intense partisanship that we have seen now, certainly for the last 10 years and maybe a little bit more, where it gets to the point where it seems that the losing side in an election, no matter who it is, simply not to want to work with the other side. And just the idea is to do what you can to prevent anything from happening until you get your next shot and the next election rolls around.
Well, it's what we were talking about before, which is money's at the root of all evil. And since the party committees and the national PACs control all the wealth, ultimately, it's very tough for candidates to stake out on their own, and that's why all the Republicans oppose the health care bill and why the Democrats virtually all supported it, because ultimately, if the party committees say, we're not going to be with you, we're going to block your fundraising, you can stand up for principle once, but try raising money the next day. Not going to happen.
Other callers here. Someone on a cell phone is next in line, and this is line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Despite what the first caller said about people owning the airwaves, I mean, it does require the money. And right now, the system is really slanted towards the incumbents. What is something like 95% plus of incumbents are reelected. So what can be done as far, and the people that are in are the ones who make the rules governing elections. So what, if anything, can be done to change that system?
Well, there is one thing that can be done. We haven't gotten to it yet. It's redistricting reform. We got to take the power out of the hands of state legislators and give it to nonpartisan commissions so we have real elections. Because if I draw the lines, it doesn't really matter how angry the citizenry get. I can create enough all-Democratic or all-Republican districts to frustrate, in large part, the will of the people. We just need to have a system that has competitive elections so that we can have the voters offered a real choice.
Is that something that could be, you know, promoted through voter referendum and voter initiative?
Absolutely, and every time there are referenda on the subject, they invariably pass and they invariably carry, and the politicians do the best they can to ignore them.
All right, well, thank you.
All right, let's go to another caller. This is Champaign County, and it's line number two. Hello.
That's I.
Yes.
Okay, this is a little bit of a digression again, but I hope not too much. You're talking a lot about the power of money in politics, but I wanted to go back and revisit the NAFTA, the way it was sold. And I don't know what role you had at the time in participating in that, but, you know, people knew that it was going to exacerbate the problems in the border because part of NAFTA and some of the enabling legislation called for more border security. So I'm just saying that the way trade is still being sold is, I think, is fraudulent in a lot of ways. It's just, you know, with Clinton apologizing to Haiti for dumping Arkansas rice and insisting on using the IMF to do the it has this international dimension, and it's I think it's a good test case, and I don't know that you've probably treated in your book, because the selling of NAFTA was bipartisan, and it was enabled by Clinton, and we still have that same kind of trade. Chinese trade. The most of the companies there are U.S., so it's not like it's even the complexities are rife, and you might regard it as a digression from the idea of just changing something here or there in the political system, but a lot is at stake. And the corn that we see around here in Illinois is being dumped on Mexico, and it's exacerbating all of those problems. And it's largely to, you know, ADM and those companies pouring lots and lots of money into that campaign.
Well, is that something, Mr. Schoen, that you can talk about?
Sure, I can talk about it. I mean, look, the one thing that you do get in politics is policy differences. And we could argue this morning the merits or the demerits of free trade. I mean, Obama's now moving to try to move forward with enabling the trade agreement, I think, with Korea. And there are those who believe that free trade will encourage more economic growth. There are others who believe that we've exported too many jobs overseas. I think those are legitimate policy debates. I was not involved in the NAFTA dispute, but it struck me that that was a fair and reasonable debate where both sides had their opinions aired without any malevolent interests controlling the process. There were certainly labor unions on one side, business on the other, and that struck me as a fair discussion. You may not like how it came out, but struck me as a fair discussion. And so from my point of view, if we have more debates where there are clear understanding of interests and clear understanding of benefits and costs, and the people decide, I think that's probably to the good.
Well, we're almost at our midpoint here. I've got another caller here, but let me then just ask a question about media coverage, because one of the things that you write about in the books, and I'm sure that the people will be very critical of, is the failure of the news media to get into depth when it comes to particular issues. And is that something that you address?
Well, it is something I'm absolutely concerned about, because, you know, we talk about the negativity of politics, but if the news media said, gee, we're not going to cover negative campaigns, we only want to cover, you know, your jobs program or your position on cap and trade, well, the politicians would change their tune. But, you know, the media is obsessed with negative politics, personal attacks, et cetera, gossip, et cetera, et cetera. And that's what gets the attention, and that's where politicians go. And surprise, surprise, when you put out your five-point jobs policy, not too many people listen.
Edgewood, Illinois, this is the next caller, line one. Hello.
Yes, I hope I'm on the subject today because I missed the opening. But the IRS releases a list every year of the top 400 taxpayers. And if you look at that list, it's pretty amazing because they made a average income of $363 million in 2007, which was last year it was released. That's $1 million a day. And these people paid 16.8 or 9%. The number is there on the website, the government website, taxes. We had a budget surplus in 2001, and these people were paying about 23%. And before 1996, they were paying about 27%, these 400 people, the top ones. This is going to be a huge issue. And I would hope it's going to be a huge issue in this next election because those tax cuts are scheduled to expire this year. In fact, a person with $9 billion in assets died this year, and there's zero inheritance tax this year. So their descendants or heirs inherited that entire amount with no inheritance tax whatsoever, which cost the taxpayer probably $4 billion. Yet I hear Republicans out there screaming that we can't pay for unemployment and other things. Can you address this issue?
Sure. I mean, I think the wealthy will almost certainly pay more going forward for the reasons you suggested about the Bush tax cuts expiring. But I also think...
I think that we have lost the caller there, the guest. We're going to have to put things on hold and see if we can get lined up with our guest again. Okay, we're going to get him back on the line, and this would be just about the time that I'd get things reset anyway. So let's do that. If everybody will hold on, we'll get back with Doug Schoen. He's been a Democratic Party advisor for the past 30 years. He's founding partner of Penn, Schoen & Berland. He was an advisor, strategic advisor, to President Bill Clinton during the 96 reelection campaign. He also has advised a lot of other politicians, among them Michael Bloomberg, mayor of New York, former Indiana Governor Evan Bayh, and also former British Prime Minister Tony Blair. And we're talking this morning about his book, The Political Fix, which is subtitled Changing the Game of American Democracy from the Grassroots to the White House. It is published by Times Books, and it takes a look at, and many of our callers have made these points, it takes a look at a lot of the things that make people really unhappy about American politics, things that include the way campaigns are financed, how primaries are run, how elections are covered. These are all things that Mr. Schoen argues in his book can actually be changed, and doing that would really transform America's political system. So that's what we're talking about here this morning, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. You may also email your comments to will-talk@illinois.edu. Mr. Schoen, I think we got you back.
Yep, I'm back.
We lost you there for a moment. Anyway, you were talking a little bit about tax policy in response to what the caller had to say, and right at that point we lost you. So maybe you
pick
it up again.
Yeah, no, what I was saying was tax rates on the wealthy are almost certainly going to go up, not only because of the expiration of the Bush tax cuts, but also because of the fiscal woes the country is facing, and the near certainty that we're going to need to raise revenue, and that overall rates will be going up. So I think those 400 people will be paying a higher percentage of their income in taxes, and that's all to the good.
Yeah. I want to get in an email here, and the person who writes in lists three things that obviously he thinks that would be good. One, I know at least at one of these three things you do actually favor. His three items here are term limits, eliminate the Electoral College, disband the Senate. I don't think that you probably would be in favor of disbanding the Senate, but
no,
I don't
think I advocated disbanding the Senate. I do absolutely favor getting rid of the Electoral College because I don't think we should have a Senate or a presidential election that turns on 17 or 18 states and ignores the biggest states like New York and California. I don't think that makes any sense at all. And so I advocate a popular election for president. There was a first point, and it's temporarily slipped my mind.
It was term limits.
Term limits, yeah. I mean, I sort of think, we don't need a permanent professional political class, and I think we do better without it.
Hmm. I think it's interesting that it seems that every time the election cycle comes, every time a presidential election comes around, at least over the past few, people say, this Electoral College, I don't really understand it. I don't know why we have it. Maybe we should get rid of it. And maybe there's a little bit of discussion, and then we have the election, and then it goes away, and nobody talks about it for another three years.
It's very sad that this happens because, look, Bush v. Gore in 2000 brought the issue into fine relief. But to me, it's an even bigger problem that fundamentally most elections, even the 2008 election, but most elections are just down to a few swing states. And given that, the American people, the vast majority of them, don't get to see the candidates and don't get a chance to have a real choice or a voice in the process.
I think we have another caller here on our toll-free line. Let's talk with them. Line number four. Hello.
Hey, good morning. You know what? You're right. You're right on a lot of stuff, but hey, I chose to go a third-party candidate. And I have a friend of mine that's running. He'll be running up against Bill Foster. And you will not believe what the two-party system tries to do to keep anybody else from running out in elections. There's a lot of corruption going on in here, and it's just insane. Cause I get this from a lot of people who say, well, we don't have a choice. You're right, you don't have a choice when the two parties kind of put a cap on anybody else trying to run. I think it's unfair. It's always been unfair. I think term limits is another thing. I think we need to go down to, like, maybe for the Senate, two terms, and for the House, maybe a term, three terms or something, but they've been in there way too long. There's, you know, people like Ted Kennedy and the gentleman who just died recently. I mean, how long do you want these guys to be professional politicians? It throws a wrench in everything that anybody wants. We're being taxed to death while the rich go walking, you know, basically free, tax-free when it comes to this. Something's got to be done, and I like what you're saying out there, even coming from a Democrat.
Well, I'll say this. I wrote a book called Declaring Independence, where I argued precisely what the caller is saying, which is that the only thing the two parties can appear to agree on is keeping third parties off the ballot, and I think that's the ultimate in corruption, because at the very least, we ought to give people a choice. So I'm for term limits. I'm for opening up the electoral process. I'm for allowing multiple parties to compete and contest elections. And I would say to the caller, if we had more people like him active in the political process, we'd have a better system.
And you, so those sorts of things, in addition to something we talked about a little bit earlier about how districts are drawn, you think that that would go some way to addressing this problem or this complaint that people have that when they do vote or when they look at the candidates that they're on the ballot, they're unimpressed, uninspired, and disinclined to participate because they just don't like the choices that are there on the paper or on the screen or however they're doing it.
Absolutely. I mean, I think because we fence choices out and we don't really listen to different and disparate opinions, we retard the ability of the American people to face the broadest possible choice and have the best possible democracy.
Yeah. I'm just curious about something, and this maybe again goes back to some of the things you write about right early on in the book, the fact that while there were a lot of people that were very excited about the candidacy of Barack Obama, and perhaps some people who voted who otherwise would not have, actually, when you take a look at the numbers of the turnout, that turnout in 2008 was really not that much above the last time around.
Yeah, I mean, for all the talk about how there was this horde of new voters, and there were certainly some, the numbers were not dramatically different from 2004. I think there were a few Republicans who stayed home and a few new voters who showed up, but fundamentally, there's a whole group of people who, like the last caller, feel left out by the system and choose either to get angry or sometimes to just stay home and keep their own counsel.
What do you now? I'm just interested in getting a quick thought about the what is called the Tea Party movement and where you think that comes from, where those voters fit, and whether the presence of those people will make a difference and in what way it will make a difference.
Well, I think the Tea Party movement reflects a lot of what we're talking about this morning, which is frustration with the established political order. Mm. And I think that there's real sense that Washington is out of touch, is engaging in big spending and big taxing, and that there's a need to return to core principles. And the Tea Party movement is a reflection of a system that does not work and needs to be fixed.
Well, I always, you know, when you take a look at the kinds of things that people who identify with the Tea Party talk about and the issues that really concern them. And then if you ask this question, well, if those people are going to vote, if they're likely voters, who are they most likely, in what way are they most likely to go? And it seems to me that they're disenchanted Republicans or maybe they're libertarians or, you know, they're certainly on the right side of the political spectrum. So you wonder, is it more likely if they're going to have an effect that what it's going to do is that it's going to affect the potential candidates who are Republican candidates, and what that's going to do to the GOP is to shove it back over to the right, and that then you have to ask this bigger question, well, overall, what sort of effect is that going to? It's certainly going to have an effect on the Republican Party, and already has, but will it have an effect overall on American politics?
Well, in a couple of ways. First, I think it's good for the system that people who are angry, however they feel, have their voices reflected. Second, I think it's going to help the Republican Party in the short term in the midterm elections. I think it's going to galvanize their votes. And third, and perhaps in the long term, it hurts the Republican Party because it pulls them to the right and outside the mainstream. But on the other hand, if people feel deeply that the system is not working and they offer some solutions, then maybe, just maybe, the system benefits from hearing these different points of view.
Do you think that the Democrats will lose control of the Congress in the midterm?
I think very good chance they're going to lose the House and then the Senate. I see them losing, I don't know, 7, 8, maybe even 9 seats. Mm.
Our guest in this part of Focus is Douglas Schoen. He is a longtime Democratic Party advisor, political consultant, founding partner of Penn, Schoen, and Berland. And as I mentioned, he has worked as an advisor to a number of politicians, including President Bill Clinton, Michael Bloomberg, New York City Mayor, former Indiana Governor Evan Bayh, former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, quite a number of others. If you're interested in American politics, you might look at his book, The Political Fix, in which he makes a number of points about things that could be done to change American politics and address some of the things that make people really unhappy about American politics. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. And we'll talk next with someone in Urbana, and that's line 2. Hello.
Just a word about term limits. The great danger of term limits is that it would destroy institutional memory in the legislative bodies. The two examples he picked actually embody that value: Teddy Kennedy and Robert Byrd. Kennedy probably had the most constructive record of any member of the Senate over the last century. Byrd embodied institutional memory, and while I didn't always agree with him, I developed great respect for him. Thank you.
All right,
well,
Ms. Schoen.
Look, those are fair points, and you know the thing about both politics and life is that there are not black and white answers to every question all the time. But that being said, for every Ted Kennedy or even Bob Byrd, there are, I think, tens of politicians who perhaps have a well-deserved retirement out of them. And, you know, I think if a legislator has 2 terms in the Senate, as the caller suggested, or 12 years, then I think that's pretty good. And we may well give up some institutional memory and, in exchange, get some fresh faces. And I guess I'd like to think that's not all bad.
All right. And let's go to, I think we have a previous caller. I just would like to maybe do a follow-up to his comments in Edgewood, line 1. Hello?
Yeah, thank you.
Sure.
Obviously, we have a deficit, which the tax people, the tax protest people and everybody else is really, really upset about. And what are we going to do? And I brought up the IRS 400 people because it's my favorite 400 people in the world, I admit it. And they those people paid over 2% of all the federal income tax in 2007, and they represented about 1.8% of all the income. 42% of the federal income is from payroll taxes, or 43% is, and 42% is FICA taxes. These people paid virtually zero FICA taxes. I believe, and a lot of other people believe, that they are not paying their fair share. At 16.8% is what they're paying. If you go look at your own paycheck, you're paying a lot more than 16.8, yet the richest people in America, the ones who made an average of $363 million in 2007, $1 million a day, paid 16.8, and what did the average worker pay? I think this is something that needs to be highlighted by the media, and I wonder why it's not.
Well, again, Mr. Schoen, you can comment.
Well, look, I think, as I said, the issue will be addressed, and the wealthy will be paying more. I think there is a heightened sense in America that there is a disparity between the incomes of the most wealthy Americans and ordinary Americans. I think it's destructive, but we don't live in a culture that supports redistribution by and large. If you ask people if they support socialism or capitalism, they support capitalism, and they do support policies that give people incentives to create jobs. So I guess what I would say is you use tax policy to encourage desirable social behavior. Sometimes people pay lower aggregate taxes than they might otherwise, but public benefit is created. So to me, it's, again, a complicated question, one that should be debated.
To another caller here, and this would be someone in Urbana, and line three. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
This is changing the subject, although I think the previous caller's point is, and the your guest's point about this tax needing to change is very, very major, and I'm hoping that he's right, that it's got to change and will. My call is concerning informing the American public about the records of our people, our elected officials. And I just wonder if he's aware of or promote in favor of, I certainly am, a group called Project Vote Smart that has spent a great deal of volunteer effort, 2 weeks at a time, of across the board of age groups and so forth. They're in Montana, and what they're doing is tabulating, and they have been for 10 or 15 years now, tabulating the votes of those we have elected and presenting them in a free booklet if one wants it, and now they're getting much more organized online, to present the voting records on major issues by our congressional reps and our senators, and also now to the state level, the votes of the state legislatures in every state. And the organization was set up with the idea it had to be bipartisan, and I say bipartisan, although the comments about Green parties and things are very relevant too. But in this case, we're talking about the two strong suffocating parties of Democrats and Republicans. It was initiated that on their sponsors, they would only take a Republican to be on the board of their operation if they took a corresponding Democrat. And so their supporters have always been bipartisan. Jimmy Carter is still one of them, and Gerald Ford is still one of them, and George McGovern and Barry Goldwater, Geraldine Ferraro, John McCain, Dukakis, Bill Frist. They all are supporters, and I don't think people know much about this organization that is trying very hard to inform the American public about what the elected people are doing. So I wondered if you knew about Project Vote Smart.
Yes, I'm familiar with it. I think it's a good cause. I think we need a lot more projects like Project Vote Smart, and I think that anything that encourages bipartisanship, a review of candidate positions on the issues, and an effort to offer a dialogue, feedback, an interactive process between the political class and the electorate is a good thing. So I can only commend the caller for her interest, her time, and her involvement.
And certainly we would have to say now that today, for someone who has Internet access, there is a lot of information about elected officials, about their positions, about who gives them money. There should be that kind of information available when people are running for office. There's plenty of information on the big issues from a variety of points of view. And what we would hope is that we would have an engaged and informed citizenry. What's discouraging is that it, and maybe this is just, you know, there are a few egregious examples of this that you can point to and they get a lot of attention, but sometimes you get the impression that people who do vote are going in there and they don't even know who it is that they're voting for.
Well, that's very discouraging, and I think the availability of information online is a huge positive. I think we're seeing that there are starting to be voters and citizens who do the kind of research that you're suggesting quite appropriately is necessary and beneficial. And I think we just have to hope for more.
Mm. And I'm sure that there are some people that maybe they're not inclined, maybe they're too busy, you know, for whatever reason. They don't have hours and hours and hours to spend doing research on candidates and issues. There are some people that they love to do that, and that's almost a hobby or an obsession. But I don't know that how many people we can reasonably expect will actually do that.
Well, I don't know. I mean, we can give people the information. I don't think we want to live in the kind of society that is coercive, that requires people to do political research. On the other hand, with the Internet, as you suggest, we have unprecedented levels of information available at our fingertips.
We just have about 5 minutes left with Douglas Schoen in this part of Focus. He's a longtime Democratic political advisor and is the author of a recent book that looks at how we could change American politics. The title of his book is The Political Fix. We have a few other callers here, and we'll go next to someone in Chicago. Line four. Hello.
Have you had the opportunity to consider the effect of global elitists in weaving and dealing internationally upon elections, wherever they may be? I've heard some books and articles being written. One is a crisis by design, and others, the web of debt we're in, and so on, that point out the international connections and intrigue that, and of course, corruption that goes on by a handful of those who are so financially set internationally that they can deal and control elections throughout the world. Certainly, those who control the media, like in Italy, Berlusconi controls the media in Mexico, the richest man down there controls the media, and then other areas where the financial, power bases lie, have their hooks into everything that's going on.
Well, I'm worried, first of all, about just trying to make a small dent in the problems facing our own country. There's certainly an issue around the world of concentration of wealth and power in a few hands, and that's a problem here and perhaps more of a problem in other nations around the world. But I'll save my prescriptions for fixing or addressing the issue of global elitism to the next time I'm on the program.
All right, let's go on to another caller. This is Champagne in line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I have a beef about the term redistribution of wealth. It's such a powerful thing that you label any program redistribution of wealth, and it's dead. It's toast. And it's only called redistribution of wealth when the money's going from the poor to the rich. What about all the money that we pay in taxes, and it goes to, for example, civilian contractors, to the military? Greg Mortensen writes in Stones into Schools that it costs the military $2 million to build something in Afghanistan that he could build for $15,000. They're hiring the same Afghanis that he does to do the work. The rest of the money goes to civilian contractors. They skim the rest of that off. That's redistribution of wealth.
Well, look, there is a real problem with contracting, particularly in the Afghanistan and Iraqi wars. The problem is our contracting rules are so rigid that the only ones who figured out how to win our contracts, in Afghanistan at least, are people who are probably less honest than we would want them to be and more politically connect and corrupted than they should be. So it's a real problem, but let's just say the issue of redistribution and how much and in what way is one of those enduring issues we'll be debating a very long time.
Well, I'd agree with that.
All right,
okay,
and let's go to line three. This is also somebody in Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd like to ask the caller, guest, a question about, it's called runoff voting. And as far as runoff voting goes, I wonder what the caller thinks about how we could achieve that as far as getting the system to be more balanced between the two parties. A caller was asking earlier about third parties getting into the system, and I think that runoff voting, the system where, you know, different candidates are able to compete against each other and voters do not necessarily vote for one person, how a system like that might be.
You know, the caller raises a very good issue, and we're considering instant runoff voting as a way of potentially going forward in New York City where I live. It's used in, I think, 10 cities in America and has been, I think, largely successful. I must confess, I don't know enough about its actual operation to know how much it will potentially do, but it strikes me that it's a discussion and an experiment very much worth considering.
I'm going to have to jump in here. My apologies here to, I think I might have one more person I'm leaving dangling here, but we're just at the end of the time. We've covered a lot of ground very quickly. If you'd like to go over it again in some more depth, I would suggest you look at the book, The Political Fix, by our guest Douglas Schoen, S-C-H-O-E-N, and it's published by Times Books. He's a longtime Democratic Party advisor, founding partner of Penn, Schoen, and Berland. And Mr. Schoen, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
One thing I would like to mention also for people who are here in Champaign-Urbana, if you're interested in hearing some discussion of Illinois politics, next week on the campus, the Illini Union Bookstore will be presenting their off-the-page summer book festival. And there are a number of things going on in connection with the festival, and probably the easiest way to find out about it is to go to their website. But I do want to mention something that I'm involved in. Next week on Tuesday at noon, there'll be a discussion of Illinois politics. I'm going to moderate, and the two guests will be Jim Nolan and Rick Winkle, two guys who, between them, have had a lot of experience following Illinois politics. They are co-authors of a recent book, Illinois Politics, A Citizen's Guide. So we'll talk and take some questions from whoever is there in the audience. So again, this is over the noon hour. It's noon, Tuesday, July 13th, this is at the Illinois, the Illini Union Bookstore. As part of their off-the-page summer book festival. So that's next week on the U of I campus.